We've all wondered, I'm sure, why clever people do stupid things. We know why stupid people do stupid things, but we can all be stupid. A new book has become a New York Times bestseller because it uses the latest research out on intelligence to explain why being bright and brainy is no protection against being dense and dim. David Robson is a science writer specialising in neuroscience and psychology. He's written for BBC Future, New Scientist, Nature, The Guardian, Observer, Washington Post. And now he has written The Intelligence Trap, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things and How to Make Wise Decisions. This we all want to know. Hello, David.
Hello, thanks for having me.
I can't think of a more marvellous beginning to a non-fiction book. You give us, right at the start, a man named Cary, who can be found on the internet. He believes he was abducted by an alien in the shape of a raccoon with shifty black eyes. He believes we can travel through space on the astral plane, that astrology is bang on the money, and that there's no relationship between AIDS and HIV. And yet, David, and yet, can you finish the story, please?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, hearing all of these things about Cary, you would not assume he was intellectually brilliant, shall we say. But in fact, despite all of these very odd beliefs, and in fact some very dangerous ones, he has in fact won a Nobel Prize. And it's not just for a kind of obscure discovery. He actually really laid the foundations for all of the genetic testing that's so important for medicine today. So a really brilliant mind, but this man, Cary Mullis, also holds some incredibly foolish opinions.
It is a startling example. Yeah, one of the people behind the Human Genome Project has these views. Okay, it's a great way to begin. Why did you write this book? I mean, we feel instinctively that maybe we shouldn't be governed by the sharpest minds in the room, that they may have strange ideas, some of them. But we do equate IQ with rationality, and I think you once felt the same, didn't you?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, I would often come across these kind of brilliant people like Cary Mullis, and, you know, you would really be astounded by their intelligence. And I would never want to kind of take away from the fact that intelligence really is important and can help you to achieve really great things. But it was also while I was working as a journalist that I would come across these very odd stories, like about Cary Mullis's other strange ideas. In fact, that is so common that some science writers have even coined this term called Nobel Prize disease, because there are quite a large number, considering, of these Nobel Prize winners who have these very strange opinions later in life. You know, like Luc Montagnier, who, you know, won a Nobel Prize for, in fact, full work on HIV and making that link between HIV and AIDS. He has later come out to support some views that sound very close to homeopathy. So it was really writing about these people and finding that there were kind of two sides to their genius. It could lead them to greatness, but also lead them to these very bizarre, very foolish opinions that really made me want to investigate how that could be and how intelligence could be a blessing and a curse.
It's funny you mention that. We have talked in a previous interview on a completely unrelated topic, really, about Nobel Prize winners changing their minds about things later in life. You talk about the intelligence trap. It's the title of your book, and you use a useful analogy, David, of a fast car to explain what you mean.
Yeah, intelligence, as we measure it with tools such as the IQ test, is really like the raw power that you might have in a car's engine. So obviously, that can be incredibly useful to help you to get to places quickly. But with a car, you also need to have all of these other instruments to make sure that you navigate it correctly. So you need the steering, a GPS system to kind of show you where to go. You need good brakes to help to stop you when you might be going off track. And I would say very similarly with intelligence, that intelligence can help you to reach your goals very quickly, but you need other checks and balances to make sure that you apply that intelligence in the correct way. Otherwise, it might also lead you off track, or, you know, lead you off a cliff in the way that we see with someone like Cary Mullis. And I would say this view itself isn't especially new. So philosophers such as Descartes had also considered that intelligence could be a vice as well as a virtue. But what's really new now is that this very robust scientific evidence helps us to explain how that happens and really helps us to explore the nuances of that and shows us how we can avoid those kinds of errors as well.
Just to take care of the who cares about IQ anymore question, you're really talking about what we all agree are really smart people. Have I got that right? You acknowledge, as have other researchers, that in fact grit will get you further in life than IQ. But you're basically talking about what we all understand as a big brain.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, I think, you know, grit is incredibly important, but so is IQ. I mean, it's not a perfect measure, absolutely. And, you know, I really question whether it should be used in schools to try to predict a child's progress. I think that can be quite limiting to kind of have this almost self-fulfilling prophecy there. But scientifically speaking, it is a fairly good predictor for the way that people will perform later in life, but also disadvantageous in these very serious ways.
I'm glad you broadened it out from the very bright, because that's one of the points of your book. But just staying with the very bright for purposes of illumination and entertainment, Albert Einstein, Arthur Conan Doyle, Thomas Edison. I wonder if you would briefly tell us about their cognitive foibles to cheer us all up.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you think of someone like Einstein, you know, kind of in everyday life, we almost use the word Einstein as a synonym for genius. And his thinking is almost so far beyond the realms of what a normal person can think and imagine. It's just almost unbelievable. He's almost like this kind of magician in the way he came up with those incredible theories of the way the universe would work. But a lot of those theories really were quite intuitive. He really did rely on a kind of gut feeling to get there. Now, the problem was that intuition later in his life did lead him astray. So for 25 years, he was trying to work on this theory of everything that would, you know, just basically help to explain how all the important parts of physics fit together and could explain the universe as we see it. He absolutely hated the idea of quantum physics and just would not contemplate that could be part of his theory. And, you know, this was for 25 years, he would keep on coming up with new ways to try to get his theory to work, but it was just never going to. And a lot of his colleagues at conferences and at his university in Princeton in America, they eventually found him so embarrassing that they would really try to avoid him because they couldn't bear to see this great man working on such a fool's errand. And so to me, that really demonstrates this way that the use of your intelligence has to be very well guided and it has to be updated. You have to be able to form new opinions with evidence. And even Einstein was not able to do that in this particular case. And it was the great tragedy of his life that he failed to do so.
There are thinking mistakes, and we all know what they are. It's almost as if you're describing what happens beyond thinking. Do people like Einstein believe they have special apprehensions of the way things are that are just a bit ineffable, but they are convinced of them because they're really intelligent? And maybe that applies to a whole lot of people about a whole lot of things.
I think that's a really good point here, is that, I mean, there are a number of different processes at play with someone like Einstein. But also, you know, with maybe people who wouldn't be considered such geniuses, but who are smarter than the average person, that they can suffer from this phenomenon called earned dogmatism. And that's the idea that once you reach a certain level of like education or expertise in your field, you can kind of close your mind to new ideas because you basically know everything that there is to know about that subject, or so you believe. And that's quite dangerous because it does stop you from updating your ideas, and new evidence in any field is going to come along at some point that's going to cause you to question your views. Now, as a medical journalist, I come across that quite a lot when I'm reporting on new evidence that maybe questions the status quo within medicine. And so sometimes I will see earned dogmatism in a lot of doctors who really, it's not just that they don't agree with the findings, it's that they refuse to even engage with them. They would even refuse to read the scientific papers to form an articulate argument about why they might be wrong.
Shutting your mind down because of a reluctance to admit new information is one thing, but intuition is another. And if intuition let you win the Nobel Prize, but also lead you completely off the road and into the woods. What's to be done? I mean, you wouldn't know a great idea from a terrible one, presumably.
Right. I think I'm really glad you raised that, because I certainly think that intuition is still powerful. And intelligent people, and especially experts, you know, people who have devoted their life to studying or to understanding their own field, they often do have very good intuitions. They don't have to think about things deliberatively all the time. Now, the problem is that even though that can help them to make very quick, very rapid decisions very often, there's still a sizable number of cases when they do make mistakes. So, for example, in medicine, if we return to that, 15% of doctors' initial diagnoses are wrong, probably because they're using their intuitions that are right most of the time, but are wrong in those 15% of the cases. Now, the scientific evidence would show that you shouldn't just ignore your intuitions, because you are losing all of that immense power from them, but you have to learn to be more reflective about them. And that process, which people call reflective thinking and reflective and analytic thinking, is really the most important part of the process, to use your intuition and then to question it. And that can massively improve your decision making.
On page 49 of your book, I think courtesy of the London School of Economics, come the everyday perils of high intelligence. Everyday perils, all at once, in a rush. And they're a bit frightening. And I won't go through them all, but I'll just reading your book now. People with high IQs also just as likely to face financial distress, missing mortgage payments, bankruptcy. People with very high IQs, doesn't help them with their credit cards. They tend to consume more alcohol, maybe more likely to smoke or take illegal drugs. We don't know this, I think, until we read your book. We think that they've got personal weaknesses. We all have. But it's interesting that intelligence is no salvation against that kind of stupidity or that kind of emotional frailty.
Yeah, I was very surprised by a lot of those findings, because as you mentioned earlier, we do tend to equate intelligence with rationality. I think you can explain some kind of foolish behaviours of intelligent people as being just a general lack of common sense or lack of social skills, for example. But you would expect rationality, weighing up evidence, thinking and planning about the future, to be something that would come naturally to people who are much more intelligent. It's a little bit similar to dyslexia, where you might be intelligent, but you have a specific problem with reading and with literacy. In a similar way, you could be very intelligent, but also just fail to apply that intelligence to your rational thinking. And that can explain all of these kind of problems that you mentioned, the kind of unhealthy behaviours and really poor financial decision making and a susceptibility to fraud. Now, what I find interesting there is that there are now really good tests of rationality that look at your susceptibility to certain biases and thinking errors, and they can predict much better your kind of decision making in all of these real world examples. So we really know now that they are two very separate traits, and we should maybe be measuring and cultivating rationality in just the same way that we've been measuring and trying to cultivate intelligent abstract thinking in schools and universities.
The Intelligence Trap, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things and How to Make Wiser Decisions. David Robson is talking to us. People with university degrees are more likely to believe in UFOs and to subscribe to paranormal beliefs. I suppose we can argue that we haven't yet fully established the presence of the aliens among us, David, and the extra dimensions of psychic space. I suppose there's a possibility that these clever people are right and we just haven't arrived there, but you and I suspect they're not.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think the truly rational position on these kinds of issues is to just say we don't know, but we can't absolutely rule out the possibility. But I would say the vast, you know, weight of the evidence goes against the existence of the paranormal. There has been, despite a lot of skepticism, a huge amount of scientific research that has tried to measure, for example, things like precognition, or, you know, that's really tried to test the kind of talents of mediums and spiritualism and all of that. And none of them have been able to show scientifically that there's anything in it. So although if you're being 100% rational, you can't rule out that there might be an experiment in 10 years' time that actually does show something we don't understand. I think like the most rational and you would hope the most intelligent perspective would be that as of now, there's no evidence for that.
There is confirmation bias, which I think we all know about roughly, but there's also disconfirmation bias, which I'm not sure we do know about.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess confirmation bias is where you're kind of collecting the information to support your point of view. Disconfirmation bias is almost the opposite. You're trying to destroy the arguments against your point of view. So you're really just looking for any kind of loophole that will show that the argument against your opinion is wrong. Intelligent people are very good at that disconfirmation bias. They're very good at dismantling arguments to support their own point of view.
So very smart people process quickly, arrive quickly at opinions and reasonings, which is admirable, but which they can then rationalize for what? Protection of their self-image? Why?
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's to protect their kind of identity. And it's really important for especially the kind of beliefs that you maybe really cherish and hold dear to yourself. And I think the problem here is that you might feel that, say, you're a Republican and you see evidence that would support climate change and suggest your opinion is wrong. That can be quite threatening because it might also lead you then to question all of the other opinions and beliefs that come with your political ideology. So soon your whole worldview would seem like it might start to collapse if you start to accept that one fact. So that's when your kind of motivated reasoning, as it's called, kicks in and you apply your intelligence to protect that belief and to protect your identity so that you don't have this very troubling feeling of your whole world collapsing around you. I think like actually the left has some very strong views about nuclear power, for example, that don't match this scientific consensus. The same with things like genetically modified organisms. You would also find, for example, that people on the left might be more likely to reject the value of vaccines and to fear that vaccines might cause autism. And that obviously, again, is something that goes against the scientific consensus here. So I do think that there are big issues across the political divide. And I absolutely would not endorse the view that, for example, Democrats are more rational than Republicans. It absolutely depends on the specific issue that you're studying. And everyone really is going to be susceptible to some of this motivated reasoning in some way within their lives.
You've got great examples in your book, the gullibility of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle regarding the spirit world, which I think people may be broadly aware of. Thomas Edison, of course, a fantastic brain, but in fact unwilling to really think through the applications of electricity delivery to America, to American homes.
Yeah, he believed that electricity would be best delivered to people's homes through direct current, whereas the other people working at the time, including like other companies, really believed that the best alternative was alternating current, where the voltage fluctuates very quickly, because that reduces the amount of energy that is lost during transmission. So it's much more economically viable. With direct current, you just lose a huge amount of energy as heat. So it could never really transmit electricity over a long distance. But Edison was absolutely convinced he was right on this. He sacked his engineer, who happened to be Tesla, another famous scientist, because he disagreed with him. And then he went on this kind of propaganda war where he tried to show that alternating current was far too dangerous for transmission. Now, the fact is it is more dangerous because if you do get electrocuted with alternating current, you know, you're more likely to die from that. But with suitable insulation and protection, you can vastly mitigate all of those risks. But he just wanted to show these dangers in the most public ways possible. So he would go around doing these public displays of electrocuting animals to demonstrate and to kind of scare the public. You know, I think he even electrocuted an elephant to show just how powerful it could be. And he even helped to design the electric chair, even though he was meant to be opposed to capital punishment, because he wanted the idea of death to be associated with alternating current. Now, what happened was that he didn't really persuade the public with these very public demonstrations. All he did was lose a huge amount of respect and a huge amount of money in the process, and eventually alternating current won out, and Edison was left humiliated and you know, much poorer as a result.
The somatic marker hypothesis of decision making, can you explain what that is?
That's something that I find fascinating, and that definitely helped me to reassess my own decision making. So the idea here is that we're not very good at knowing the kind of origins of our emotions, but in fact there's this kind of feedback loop from our mind to our bodies and back again. So when I feel any kind of particular emotion, what I'm feeling there really is the change in my bodily state, rather than it being a purely cognitive mental kind of state of sadness or happiness. You know, it's things like the racing of my heartbeat, or the butterflies in my stomach, or my skin prickling with sweat. It's all of those things that together we feel as the emotion, and then we categorize, and that shapes our decision making. Now, some people, due to some brain damage, there's like a break in that loop, so they don't have that kind of feedback from their body to their mind. And what you see there is that they, because they can't read these somatic or bodily markers, they're incredibly bad at decision making. And that's been shown in laboratory experiments, which are incredibly elegant in the way they've been designed, but also in their everyday lives. So they might just be stuck in complete indecision over something as simple as like where to file a piece of paper in their filing cabinet. But another time they might be completely impulsive and rash and marry someone on a whim, or invest all of their money in some kind of scam, because they just don't have good bodily signals about how to make their decisions. Now, these bodily signals are really the fuel of our intuition. They're really what guides our intuition. And the exciting thing about this work is that if you manage to train yourself to be better at reading those bodily signals and more aware of them, then you can improve your decision making. So you can maintain your intuition, but like I said earlier, you can also become a bit more reflective about where that intuition comes from. And that can be incredibly powerful in helping you to just be wiser in so many areas of your life.
Okay, and this is important. And I have to mention mindfulness, and so do you in your book. At least you're alert to the off switch that people employ with mindfulness. But we can achieve the same results in terms of bodily awareness and the benefits it gives in other ways, can't we? Why are musicians and dancers adept at this?
I mean, that's very early research, but I think it does make intuitive sense to me that they would be more adept at that. Because if you think of a dancer, they have to be very aware of what their body is doing. You know, so much of their mind is focused on the feelings of their muscles and how they're moving, that in itself is increasing this bodily awareness and kind of making them hyper aware of their somatic markers. And then that does indeed seem to improve their decision making. The same with a musician. If you think about the process of singing, for example, you're very aware of what's happening in your throat, and you know, even tiny changes in your body can really make a big difference to your sound. So it's really any of these processes that make you think a lot about your body do seem to help your decision making in a way that I find quite counterintuitive.
Although it's an old wisdom, isn't it, that the fitter you are, the better your brain works. You know, there are people who've always kind of sworn by that, and I guess this is a more refined version of that.
Yeah, that's exactly true. I mean, I think the wonderful thing about exercise is that in itself it improves the health of the brain by pumping lots of blood to your brain and washing out all of the kind of toxic materials that can build up, and helping you to kind of flush through all of these important neurotransmitters that can help your brain cells to regenerate and grow and to build new connections in your brain. So that in itself is incredibly beneficial. But then in addition to that, you also have this heightened bodily awareness that then helps you to use your brain more effectively and to use your intuitions more effectively.
In your book, noting the cognitive errors and just general daftness that a whole lot of intelligent people are guilty of, you talk about attaining, and you've mentioned it already, self-distance and perspective, emotional awareness for improving the decisions you make. We can be like Benjamin Franklin, also mentioned in your book, and we can cultivate the other person's point of view and check ourselves till the cows come home. But we can also, presumably, in doing this, end up like Hamlet, unable to make any decisions at all. Would that be the pitfall here?
Yeah, that's exactly right, which I think is why it's important to have this good balance between listening to your intuitions but not being ruled by them. And I think, you know, from what I've read of Benjamin Franklin and his life, he was very good at that, in that he was very good at allowing himself to take a step back, to acknowledge what he felt was the intuitive right decision, but then to, over the next few days, to kind of weigh up the pros and cons more analytically. And by taking that kind of process and then finally coming to a decision right at the end, he often was just a lot more rational about what he was doing, a lot wiser about what he was doing, because he wasn't ruled by his passions, but he did allow them to play a part in that decision making.
When you go for a job interview, hope it's not raining. If you want to create a dream team, put women in it. I'm scooting through some of the things I noticed in your book. Committee meetings may make you feel brain dead, and in fact also act brain dead. Auckland University students, among others, you say in your book, David, were surveyed and they were emphasising the value of open-mindedness, these young people. And yet the young seem to be just as guilty of closed thinking and moats around themselves as anyone. We're all guilty of it through our lives, aren't we?
That's interesting. So the research that I've read, some other research besides the work from the University of Auckland that you mentioned, has shown that actually when it comes to decision making about your own personal life, you know, you're at a disadvantage when you're younger. You are much more hot-headed, you're much more closed-minded, you're much less willing to take someone else's opinion because you feel your emotions very strongly, and it's very difficult to kind of disconnect from that. And as you would hope, as you get older, lots of people are just a lot better at taking a more distanced view of their life, and from realizing that their emotions may be just a small transition, but they can see past them to what would be wiser for the long term. So in that case, age really does help you in your decision making. But I do find it interesting, the research you cite about young people in their political decision making, for example, because actually there's been some fascinating work showing that, at least in the UK and the USA, it's actually the younger people who are less likely to fall for fake news and older people who are more likely to fall for fake news. And that seems to just be, I don't know why, but they really struggle with some kind of information literacy and critical thinking about what they're reading.
Older people may be more accustomed also to trusting media. It's been habitual in their consciousness for decades, probably, and all of a sudden that's being upended. A very interesting part of the book is when you analyse disasters like the Concorde crash, the Columbia space shuttle disaster, Deepwater Horizon. And David, the fascinating conclusion is to do with risk tolerance.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's something that I really hope that people do take away from the book, and they read more about this research and they apply it, because it really could save a lot of lives. And this is something that is another heuristic, another cognitive bias that is called the outcome bias. And put simply, it's this idea that if you kind of have a near miss event where a disaster almost happens but doesn't, then people's risk tolerance actually increases. So they're less aware of the risks over time. Now, that was evident, for example, with NASA, with both the Challenger and the Columbia disasters, where actually the engineers had been aware that there were these kind of technical problems caused, for example, by the weather that would put the spacecraft at risk of explosion. But because it never quite reached the level where it did cause an explosion, they kind of became complacent. They just didn't really worry too much about what was going on. Now, the fact was that actually with any of these events, it's partly down to chance. And you might have 19 times when everything goes fine, but you only need one time when it doesn't for there to be a huge disaster. It's a bit like playing Russian roulette. And that's exactly what happened. They became complacent about this risk, which was always a risk, but not a certainty. And then the disaster happened. And they didn't learn about it from Challenger. And then the same thing happened with Columbia. And you also saw this with Deepwater Horizon. There were a huge number of near misses across all the companies that had worked on the Deepwater Horizon tanker, but they just they were just ignored and the risk tolerance increased and eventually a disaster happened. And if it hadn't happened there, it would have happened somewhere else because they were just playing Russian roulette with the technology.
We've had disasters here and learned lessons from them, and you might not be familiar with most of them, but for a New Zealand audience, you know, we think of Pike River and Cave Creek and the Mangatepopo Gorge canyoning tragedy. You don't have to know about those, but you analyse core organisational characteristics that will serve people well. And we don't have time to go through them all, but the first one surprised me slightly until I saw the sense in it. A preoccupation with failure is a good idea, you say, David.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's to really kind of protect yourself against this increase in risk tolerance, this outcome bias, is that you should always, if there's risk of failure, if there's the chance of failure, you should be looking to correct those potential errors. And it's much more important to focus on that potential failure than to always be focusing on the possibility of success. Because of the way the brain is wired, it's very easy to ignore failure. And so it has to be part of the organisational culture that you do have that preoccupation with failure.
Can I ask you one more tiny thing? Are you wiser for having written this? I was just thinking as I reflected on myself when I was reading your book, and deep down my essential beliefs don't shift, I think. Wisdom, I hope, and you say it comes with age, and you say some of it doesn't and some of it does. Wisdom allows me to see the world more through others' eyes, maybe, and be more tolerant. But it doesn't really persuade me to change what I've always thought about lots of things. How's it been for you?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and it's something I'm always asking myself about. Now, I think like achieving wisdom obviously is a kind of lifelong preoccupation and goal. And, you know, it's only been a kind of 3 years since I first started looking into this. But I do think it has improved my decision making in some ways. And I think one of the most essential things that it's done is just alerted me to the possibility of error in my thinking and made me a lot more intellectually humble. So I'm much more aware now of the limits of my knowledge and to question my assumptions. And I do change my opinions on some issues. For example, I was very against genetically modified organisms, but actually going through this kind of process that I described in my book of questioning my assumptions and the sources of the information and the kind of biases and all of that that could have influenced my opinions, I actually did a pretty much 180 degree shift in my opinion there. But I'd also just say in my private life that I've been much more aware of when I might be making the wrong assumptions and always willing to just ask, like, do I really know something or do I just have the kind of illusion of knowledge there and that earned dogmatism, the feeling that because, you know, I've had a certain level of education that I must be right when I'm not.
Yeah, and the book's very valuable for making us all think about that. Very good. Thank you again for your time, David. I really appreciate it.
No, it's absolutely been my pleasure.
The Intelligence Trap, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things and How to Make Wise Decisions. David Robson on Sunday Morning RNZ National